The first question, what do people mean by conscience when they invoke it against lawful authority in the church? Notice the way the question was worded. Is not what do people mean by conscience, but what do they mean when they invoke it and are objectively disobedient, say, as Catholics? The answer here is good. I'd like to make a brief comment on it. Conscience in these cases is regarded as a personal norm whose subjective evaluation of the morality of the act supersedes the authority of the church. These persons feel that God enlightens them in a particular case or situation, and that the objective norms of the church are only relevant, or perhaps they meant relative. Well, I think myself that many people talking to them, especially those who know words, say priests, who are in objective disobedience with the church, they have really conjured up a conscience, they use the word, which is normative, not only of this particular action, but frankly normative in general. I don't know whether I made the distinction between a normative and a judgmental conscience, did I? Well, let me just go back over that and then clarify. Conscience, as normally defined, is the human reason enlightened by faith, and everyone has some faith, enlightened by faith, passing judgment on the morality of this particular action. So that conscience is the human mind enlightened by whatever faith a person has, which tells him what he should do here and now. But notice, nowhere in that definition are the norms by which this reason enlightened by faith is supposed to operate. The norms are presumed. They are presumed as somehow as coming from outside of the mind, from the objective order of nature on which the reason can reflect, and from God's revelation. So revelation, or to start the other way, the order of nature and revelation are the norms. Now, a person may not have enough of those norms. He may be mistaken in interpreting them. But as far as conscience goes, it is only that instrumental faculty to pass judgment here and now on the basis of norms, which he didn't conjure up for himself, but which he got from outside the mind. Now, these people, even though they call themselves Catholic, who challenge the church's teaching on something, what they are equivalently saying is that they have a norm which, in this case, can contravene or contradict an objective norm given to them by the church. And it is here, I think, sisters, that we are going to be in more difficulties than perhaps we anticipate. With people who will appeal, and the answer is well put, people who will appeal to a special enlightenment from God, charismatic, and I have found what I never thought I would discover, sometimes very prayerful people. Now, by prayerful, I'm being a little bit pejorative. The inward, the withdrawn people, the kind of people you would least expect to resist the church's authority. You know what? They believe they have received a special enlightenment from on high. This is part of the Pentecostal movement. You've heard about that. Here's another answer, which I think is also good, brings it out. people mean by conscience and so on, they make their conscience normative in all cases. Now, it's the in all cases, they make their own judgment normative in all cases. Then observed correctly, man has an obligation to form his conscience. In other words, conscience is a faculty which depends for its fuel or its premises or its principles. And maybe that's the word I'm... What conscience does is tell us what we are supposed to do in practice. The conscience, my own two-lobe brain, does not give me the principles. They either come from outside of me, or I am my own normal morality. Now that's put extremely, but that's the approach. When an act doesn't fit their moral code, they change the code instead of the act. Good. I mean, they shouldn't do it. The answer is good. But you notice, this is part of the whole relativism. See, the thing really sticks together. Once these two lobes, see, are the norm of morality, well, given different situations, I keep adjusting. In other words, the fluctuating, the variable position that a person can assume or does assume following this kind of thinking is because there is nothing outside of the mind to which the mind must itself first conform and on the basis of which it then passes judgment. Any observations on that before we leave this? Because this is very basic. Second question. What relationship is there between political authority in Europe and the European crisis in obedience? First, let me observe why I asked the question. There are two reasons. The first is that whether we realize it or not, a great deal of the crisis we have in the United States regarding obedience and authority is an inherited, a borrowed crisis. Whether, as I say, we recognize it or not, we are being deeply influenced by European thinking. Most of the reading in Catholic theology and morals in the United States today, say among Catholic laity, priests, and religious, and this is a safe statement, the vast majority of it is by European writers. To a point, in fact, where American publishers tell me one of their big problems is to keep the European publishers off their doorsteps. I worked for some time for a Catholic publisher. It happened to be Herder and Herder, which has become a horse of a different color in the last few years. But I worked for them. They would send me manuscripts or unbound copies of new books coming out in Germany, France, and so on. And for a fee, they usually paid me $50 a book. I'd spend about 3 or 4 hours rummaging through the book and send them a letter. Translate this book, don't translate it. If you do, do this with it. And if they shouldn't, why not? Well, any number of books that I told them, don't translate it. This is a European problem. Why raise it here? Well, for a while they were following my advice. When I discovered two titles in a row that I asked them not to publish, they published, or they paid my fee. Then we parted company. What I'm saying is that the first reason is, and this is good to know, I think, at least good to hear, that there are problems, deep-seated problems, in Europe, which I don't say we don't have any of them here, but many have been transported overseas, and we pick them up. The second reason is that I wanted to pinpoint the difference between question 2 and question 3. See, I'm asking myself, as I think we all are, what happened? How come? Where did the storm come from? Well, part of it blew in from Europe. Now, what's the relationship between political authority in Europe and the European crisis in obedience? The answer is a good one. I want to make a brief observation. As a reaction to war experiences, the feeling of the European people was to destroy everything and start all over again. Amen. I teach Europeans. Thus, the people were rebelling against injustices yielded to by dictatorships, recognizing there the people's power to rule. They aimed to suppress and dispose of such a leader who had tyrannized over them. Just about all the thrones of Europe have fallen. It's well to know that the English Empire went out of existence in our lifetime. Less than 20 years ago, I think, James Truslow Adams published, if you've ever heard or read the book, The Mistress of the Seven Seas. She's a lonely widow now. In other words, political empires have come to an end. And the italicized or in large letters here, they do not want to be dominated. Amen. This is the way they think. They're rebelling against it. And frankly, who wouldn't? Oh, I left it on the table. Typical. When I want to show something, I left it over there. Anyhow, it's over there. It's Albert Camus' book, The Rebel. Ever read it? Sister, would you mind? Thank you, sister. They are, and all of them, including their theologians. Thank you. Now, I don't recommend this for spiritual reading. This man is an atheist. He's a Nobel Prize winner in literature. And I consider the most intelligent unbeliever in modern times. In fact, I can usually help unbelievers to articulate their unbelief, thanks to Camus. At any rate, Rebel, of course, is his description of Western society. In one word, it's the rebel. What's it rebelling against? I'm sure you do this too, use yellow. First page of the introduction. Listen to this. There are crimes of passion and crimes of logic. The boundary between them is not clearly defined. We are living in the era of premeditation and the perfect crime. Our criminals, he's writing, against the dictatorships which he saw all around him. Our criminals are no longer helpless children who could plead love as their excuse. That's been the theme of all the great tragedies of history. Men doing wrong because of a great love. On the contrary, they are adults, and they have a perfect alibi, philosophy, which can be used for any purpose, even for transforming murderers into judges. Once crime was a solitary as a cry of protest. Now it is as universal as science. Yesterday it was put on trial. Today He determines the law. So he does not want the law, which is legislating crime, the murder of 6 million Jews. This picture we've got to get. At any rate, this is undoubtedly part of the psychology of the rebellion against authority, and the difficulty, not an easy one, of distinguishing between authority in political society and authority in the church. Or did you hear about the German bishop who will probably be put on trial for, is it 17 murders? Didn't he order the execution? Or was it some 17 people as a Nazi? In the meantime, he got himself ordained and as bishop. He's auxiliary, I think, to Cardinal Deppner. Pretty complex, eh? Do you get the picture? In other words, authority is not a univocal term. We Catholics know it isn't. There was an authority in political society. There was an authority in the church. The one is not the other. But it's extremely difficult for people living under an extremely despotic, authoritarian political society, sometimes which has infected some areas of the church, to now keep their vision clear and be willing to accept authority when it does come from the church. Third question, what relationship is there between political democracy in America and the American crisis in obedience? The answer, with some comment, politically Americans see authority as coming from the people. Our democratic way of life has been transferred in reference to the church's structure. Again, very, very true. In other words, from being Americans and recognizing now notice the change of pace. This is why I brought these two questions out, to help you in trying to evaluate for yourselves and for your students what went wrong. Now, the subtlety, of course, is that political democracy we consider good. And there are aspects of democracy which are or should be present in the church. Yet the church's authority is not democratic. And when the one becomes the other, then you're in trouble. I would add that beyond the fact of our democratic way of life being transferred to the church's structure, it is also tied in with the idea of representation, because a strict democracy, as Plato once so wisely said, cannot exist. I don't think anybody has improved on his definition of perfect democracy. Plato said, perfect democracy is chaos. Where every individual makes his own demands on a society, where nobody gives in to anybody else, that's chaos. It is rather, as Americans, our concept of political democracy is the idea of representation. In other words, we all know enough of the complexities of government not to want to be, we couldn't be, physically in Washington. The city of Washington couldn't hold 200 million people. It gets silly, right? We know that democracy means representative constitutional government. Now, the first is representative, the other is constitutional. Now, the idea of representation in the church. Now, the trouble here is that Pope John did recognize the need while retaining the church, and the term that I use, the government in the church, and this is my best definition of the church's government, is primatial collegiality. Primatial collegiality. Where the collegiality is the consecrated hierarchy, the successors of the apostles. They, in virtue of their consecration, receive from God authority that nobody has, except they, in a way, they have it. No matter how lacking they may be in intelligence compared to somebody else, the collegium, the collectivity of the bishops, but primatial, always, always subject to and in obedience the bishops to the See of Rome. A bishop has as much authority as he is obedient to the vicar of Christ, neither more nor less. The power comes to him from his consecration, but the right to exercise that power and the guarantee of its truth comes from his loyalty to Rome. Let me repeat. That sentence locks up an awful lot. The church's authority is a primatial collegiality, meaning that only those who are consecrated, having received their consecration from the successors of the apostles, have a divine right to pass on that authority to others and to exercise it over the people of God in virtue of their consecration. They receive the power. However, having the power is one thing. The right to exercise it is something else. And in matters of doctrine, it's not enough to have the right to teach, or even the fact that a man teaches, because a man can teach either truth or error. The guarantee of teaching the truth, so the right to exercise and the guarantee of teaching the truth in any bishops or in 1,000 bishops. Now, this is a tough one. And we're Catholic if we say it. We are not if we deny it. The truth of the collective hierarchy of the Catholic Church, the guarantee of its infallible teaching of the doctrines of Christ, is guaranteed only if they are loyal to and in agreement with Rome. If 1,000 bishops agree on something and the vicar of Christ says you're wrong, they are wrong. And I would have said it with rising accent if Bishop Herman were here. Now, it's this representation that I think we Americans want. Now, the trouble here is we don't realize how far more representative the government of the Catholic Church, which is primatial collegiality, is becoming, and how willing the Church is, I mean the See of Rome, is to have representation, say in the Vatican, so they know what's happening. One of my great experiences and a great grace was to work for a year with the Vatican, working with the Vatican Radio. Wonderful experience. Do you know what they most want in the Vatican? Is more Americans. If you want a job in the Vatican, sisters, let me know. I don't promise to get it, but I promise that you will be given a good hearing. But do you think Americans are jumping at the chance? No. So, representation. I would add this. On the level of, in other words, the problem that is being raised, that people, a lot of Americans, have a very strange concept of the Vatican. that they think the Pope and the Curia are so jealous of their power, they're hugging it. That isn't true. They want to serve. They want to give. And they want to know what's on our minds. To illustrate, something over a year ago, I received a letter from Bishop Zaleski, who enclosed a Xerox copy of a letter he received from Archbishop Dearden, including an enclosure that then Archbishop Dearden received from the Holy See. Dearden was asked, would he please quietly and with no publicity look into the situation of American Freemasonry, because the Holy See wants to do something about the relationship between Catholics and the Freemasons. And they realize how vastly different one country is from another. Well, I told Bishop Zaleski I would be happy to do what I could. After almost 8 months of negotiation, first time I've mentioned this publicly, we had a meeting, Bishop Zaleski and myself, in the Greater Pittsburgh Airport from 9 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon on a Sunday. He representing the bishops and myself as his consultants, with the 6 top men in American Freemasonry. One flew in from the Far East. He was allowed by the Navy to take Sunday off. For 8 hours, we discussed the possible future, improved relationships between Roman Catholicism and American Freemasonry. The report that was sent in 11 pages to the Holy See will never be publicized, but I think it illustrates the concern and the desire of the Church in Rome not to legislate beyond the needs of a particular country. Question 4. What is the basic difference between authority in the Catholic Church and authority in any other society? By the way, I did go over these, those of you that handed them in. I don't want you to feel that I have not looked at them. I picked one that somehow represents the others. Authority in the Church is divinely authorized, directly from God on down. Keep that in mind, sisters. It's the only society of its kind. Now, if you ask why, and here we could start a whole course on this aspect of ecclesiology, the ultimate reason is that the Church is a revelational society. It is not a natural society. By that I mean, it is not a society that really grows up from the reflection of the people, their awareness of their needs. Of course, God's grace is operating everywhere. But the Church is the only society in the world, in fact, in history, there will never be another like it. Sui generis. Where its very existence is a matter of faith. Its authority is a matter of faith. Who its members are is a matter of faith. What its mode of operation, its institutional structure, all of this is a matter of faith. Nobody could possibly dream up the Church. And consequently, and here's the sticker, consequently, when we come to the crucial question of the relationship of those in that society to the authority which is running that society, the visible authority, though there are many things which they can know about how the society is to be run, from reflection and the study of political science and so on, the only guarantee they have that there is even an authority, let alone how that authority is to operate, is from faith. And that consequently, it is only those, and this is the nature of this society, it is only those who have been consecrated as the successors of the apostles who have authority in this society. You don't prove that, sisters. You can't. You either take it or leave it. Because the very existence of such a society is a matter of faith. Now, if the faith which tells us there is such a society, in which the only ones who exercise ultimate and decisive authority are those who have been chosen by Christ, the 12 men, and those who have received their powers from them, really from Christ through them, well then, to suppose there's any other way in which you can break authority in this society is to deny its very essence. You see what I'm saying? So, now if we don't like the word directly from God down, well, let's find some synonym. What does this from God on downness mean? It means that God, in the person of Christ, consecrated certain men. He consecrated them. I mean, he didn't have to go around laying his hands on them. After all, he was the Son of God. He told them, do this in commemoration of me. In so many ways, he consecrated them. He's God. Receive the Spirit as the Father sent me, I send you. So, they have the power. Now, the from God on downness means, therefore, that in a mysterious, indeed in a mystical way, God directly, in virtue of a sacrament, the sacrament of orders, and by the Vatican Council, foreseeing the trouble, and Pope John was a very prophetic person. Among the things which the Vatican Council insisted on, that we stop speaking of the consecration of bishops. They are ordained.